This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This is episode 4, Witches, Broomsticks and Spells, Enchanting and Entrapping Children in Fiction.
Before we begin, we are very, very pleased to introduce a guest star onto the show, and that is James Nicol. James is a British author whose book, The Apprentice Witch, is being published by The Chicken House and will be available in July. Nice to have you on the show, James.
Hi, James.
Hello, thank you for asking me on.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the book?
Yes, so I'm a huge bookworm. I've kind of spent my life working in bookshops and more recently for library services. And I've always obviously loved books and loved stories and used to write a huge amount when I was a lot younger. But life kind of gets in the way, doesn't it? And you sort of change jobs and move house and all of that nonsense. And so there was quite a long break where I think I wasn't actually physically writing, but they were all going on in my head, had all of these ideas. And then a few years ago, I decided to kind of throw myself back into it. And I did a creative writing course. And it was my tutor that kind of said, you know, I think you might be onto something here. You should, you know, you should be doing more with this. You shouldn't just kind of let this settle. And so I thought about doing lots of different things, kind of more creative writing courses, more formal study, like a degree or something. And she's just said, well, look, if what you want to do is to write a book at the end of all of this, just get on and write a book, because you'll learn so much more from that process than you will from doing any number of courses. And so I started. I'd already got this idea bubbling away in the back of my head, which wasn't the kind of the story that had been with me for a couple of years that I kind of started several times and then sort of abandoned. Mm-hmm. It was just this completely new idea. And it was and how it came was a really clear sort of visual image of my main character, who I didn't know her name or anything about her at that point, but she was standing in a garden. It was nighttime. There were stars in the sky and she was drawing magical symbols into the night air, and I knew that she was casting some sort of a protection spell around this garden and where she was, but I didn't know why, and I didn't know anything else about her or about the story at that point. So I wrote all of this down in like a furious hurry and then sort of looked at it and kind of went, okay, now what do I do? And it just sort of built from there, really. And that was where I first met Ari Amwin, who she turned out to be. And that whole thing doesn't even exist in the book anymore, which is kind of sad, but that's writing, isn't it? Stuff has to go for different reasons. And so I worked on the kind of the very start of The Apprentice Witch with my creative writing tutor. And then what she said was to, at some point in the future when I was happy with the book and I got it to the level where I couldn't do any more to it myself in terms of editing, then I should show it to a professional editor and get some constructive feedback on the story and how to take it forwards. And then quite by chance, I heard about the Golden Egg Academy, which is an organisation that helps to develop unpublished children's writers or unagented children's writers. That's not even a phrase, is it? But there we go.
It is now.
And so when I kind of thought I was ready, I sent some stuff, but I genuinely thought that they were going to come back and say, it's not really good enough, but here's how you can make it better. And they didn't. They said it was, you know, good. And I got taken on with the Golden Egg Academy and worked with Bella Pearson, who was my mentor and editor while I was working with Golden Egg for this book. And that's how I ended up. The book went to Chicken House for them to have a look at, because they were offering scholarships to Golden Egg Academy writers, and they liked it so much that they didn't offer me the scholarship. They offered to publish it, which was even more amazing because it was totally unexpected, really. And so that was about a year ago now that happened. Had various emails and things kind of leading up to this very bizarre phone call and people asking for, could you just write us a biography, and could you just send us this, you know, a bit more of the book, and can you send us this? And I was kind of saying, well, what's going on? Why do they keep asking for all of this stuff? And nobody seemed to know the exact answer. It was just kind of came back saying they just want to make sure they're offering the right thing. And I was kind of, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. And then I remember very distinctly, it was a Tuesday morning, it was 7:45 in the morning, and I had an email from Rachel Leishen, who's one of the brilliant editors at Chicken House. And she said, are you free for a chat this afternoon? And I emailed back and said, yes, I can be free after about 4, thinking, oh, this is going to be the, well, it was a good try, but, you know, it's really not that good. And then a bit later in the day, this email came back saying, well, okay, well, here's the details of the conference call we want you to log into. And I was thinking, why are we having a conference call? This is very strange. And then, yes, then logged into this conference call, and it was Rachel Leishen and Barry Cunningham. They kind of said, well, we won't beat about the bush. Rachel has some good news for you. And she said that they really liked what I'd done with the book. I proposed some quite major changes from an earlier draft that Barry had read. And they said that they really liked what I was proposing. And they wanted to offer me a contract to publish The Apprentice Witch. So that's kind of how it all came about. And then obviously the last year's been kind of editing and editing again and a bit more editing.
Oh, we know about that, don't we, Jules?
Oh, we do, yep.
That's been quite an enchanting journey for you.
Yeah.
From start to finish.
Absolutely. I definitely think somebody somewhere has cast a spell, and I don't know who it is. But...
Well, I wonder if it isn't your main character. That description, the way she introduced herself to you, I wonder whether she wasn't casting a spell on you in some ways.
Possibly, quite possibly. I mean, there's, you know, it's kind of, there's nothing new under the sun, is there really? And I suppose that those kind of images come from a 100 books that I've read in my lifetime. So, but yes, it just wouldn't go away. And the more I kind of delved into this world that I was slowly building and creating, the more I wanted to write about it, and the more I wanted to kind of explore it. And so, yeah, I think certainly bewitched me, and hopefully it will bewitch others as well.
Well, it's already bewitched quite a few people, otherwise you wouldn't have gotten this far. So I'm
absolutely,
I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, I am. I'm particularly looking forward to it because I think it's the 7th of July it comes out, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's my birthday. That's like the best thing ever.
Aww. You can pre-order it. It can arrive.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So do you think the book chose you? I know that sounds like a peculiar thing, but among writers, it's less insane than it sounds.
That's really strange because I read Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic. Have either of you read it? And there's a whole bit in there about the fact that this idea that ideas are kind of sentient and they're like another life form on the planet. And she really believed this. And I kind of have a lot of respect for Elizabeth Gilbert. And I kind of listened, I read this bit and I kind of thought, I think she's a bit mad. I think she's actually potty. But the more I read, the more sense it started to make. So this idea that if you have an idea and you don't nurture it or develop it, it will wander off, a bit like your cat. You know, if you don't feed your cat or look after it, it's gonna, you know, wander down the road and go and be fed by the neighbors. And and she tells this story about Anne Patchett, not Anne Pratchett, which is a different writer altogether. Anne Patchett and her, they had a very similar idea for a book, which Elizabeth Gilbert had been kind of working on and off for a while, and she sort of left it eventually, and it kind of dwindled and she didn't go back to it. And then without ever mentioning this to the other writer, Anne Patchett then went on and developed this story. And when she told Elizabeth Gilbert about this book, she said, well, I had the exact same idea for a book like 4 years ago, and they'd never discussed it, they'd never shared it, she'd never shown it to anybody. And yeah, it was just really weird. So
she
I don't
didn't
know
nurture the idea, so it went walkabouts and found, well, another writer.
She thinks she actually transferred the idea when they hugged each other one time. So I don't know if somebody else had this idea and I pinched it during some kind of physical contact, but nobody's laid claim to it so far. So,
well, there's an idea onto itself, the idea that people can just steal things. From, you have someone with the ability to touch people and steal their ideas. So this
quite
famous
scared.
Rich entrepreneur who basically just goes and finds intelligent people and steals their ideas, like Gilderoy Lockhart, just a little bit more menacing. So speaking of Gilderoy Lockhart, our subject today is on witches and children's fiction. Now, obviously, from the title of your book, James, we can assume that there are witches of some nature.
There are lots of witches in my book.
And that It is a children's book. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So first of all, let's tackle the interesting question of why is it that we associate witches now with children? Because if you see witches, normally if you mention witches, people tend to think children's fiction. Whereas maybe, you know, 200 years ago, it would have been totally to the contrary.
I think it's something to do with the fairy tales and things. And I've talked about these previously in your podcast, but I think the fairy tale has become much more for children. Although I think, you know, again, in sort of recent years, when we've had this kind of resurgence again of people adapting or developing fairy stories, and it adult writers have done it, or they've aimed them at more adult readers. I think certainly, you know, I grew up with fairy tales. They were kind of my first ever stories, and whether they were things that family members read to me or whether they were things that family members told me, because it's, you know, everyone can remember at least one fairy story and kind of tell it, you know, half-heartedly well, I'm sure. But I think that's probably why, because they're so associated with childhood now, even though perhaps they've been kind of, you know, tidied up a little bit and maybe watered down for a younger audience. But I think that's why that there's this connection between all things magical and children, and perhaps it's because children are more believing of it as well. Obviously, you know, as we grow up and grow older, we kind of leave those things behind a little bit. Well, some of us do, not me. But yes, I think that's probably why.
I think there's also going to be another element to it, which is even with fairy tales, and I totally agree with everything you've said, James, witches in fairy tales tended to be the enemy. You know, you have Hansel and Gretel. The witches tended to be the bad guys. So even in the context of the fairy tale, witchcraft was associated with adulthood. And I think part of the reason... Sorry, I wasn't going to mention fairies, but I'm going to mention fairies because that's my area of study. And something I've been looking at is, of course, how fairies originally were quite menacing creatures. They were quite malicious. They weren't very nice. They had a lot of bad associations. And then during the Victorian period, they became kind of friendly. Mm. They were morphed and sort of malicious fairy characters in Arthurian legend and stuff like that. So, for instance, Morgana le Fay, who's another kettle of fish. One day I'll talk to you all about Morgana le Fay because I feel very strongly about her. But, you know, people perceive her as a bad person, but they changed it because fairies were good now. They changed her into a sorceress instead. And I think in some ways the same thing has happened, which is that you've taken something which was historically malicious and have converted it into something fun. And you can see the history of that. I mean, witches, unlike, you know, fairies was one thing, but witches themselves have a huge history, especially in Britain and in the USA. You know, people were literally burned to death for being mm-hmm. witches. There is a very gritty history there. And yet, now, some of the most popular franchises are using children, and not only associated with magic, but specifically with the word witch.
It's interesting what you're saying about witches being burnt at the stake and things, because, I mean, I live in East Anglia now, and I've lived in East Anglia my whole life, but where I grew up in King's Lynn in Norfolk, in the market square there, above one of the buildings, above the kind of the centre window on the first floor, in the brick, there is a diamond carved into the brick, and in the diamond, there's a heart. And the legend goes that a witch, I think her name was Margaret Reed, was kind of accused of being a witch, as many unfortunate women were during that period, and she was burnt alive on the marketplace. And apparently as she was burning, her heart burst from her chest and flew up and struck this window, which was where the person who had accused her lived. And this is this legend of witches. You know, there's hundreds of stories of witches in East Anglia. It was a popular spot for Matthew Hopkins, who was the witch finder general, yeah, to pop along and, you know, earn a few quid burning some poor old woman or young woman. And yeah. But again, that's a story that I must have grown up with, because I don't ever remember reading that story. I just know it.
Yeah, it's assimilated into the area, isn't it?
apparently the heart then, after it hit the building, it bounced down the road and jumped into the river and disappeared under kind of like a froth that looked a bit like a cauldron. But everybody says that that was kind of proof of her innocence, the fact that her heart burst from her chest.
I too, when I'm innocent, my heart bursts out of my chest.
Me too,
bounces.
If I'm ever accused of anything and it's not true.
It, I mean, the first time it happened, it was in the principal's office and it was very messy.
That story reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever read any Diana Wynne Jones, but the Crestomancy series, and there's a very short book in the middle, and it's basically, with the Crestomancy series, there's 9 worlds, and the Crestomancy is sort of a sorcerer who can walk between all the worlds. And in one of the worlds, just part of our history is slightly alternate, and the gunpowder plot actually happened. But it did mean that things shifted a little bit, and that while witchcraft wasn't an accepted thing, it meant that everybody had a little bit of witchcraft. And for some reason, it's just reminded me of that.
Yeah, no, do you know what? I when I was a bookseller, we used to promote Diana Wynne Jones, you know, as an alternative read for when people had read Harry Potter. But I actually didn't read them until very recently. So I'm working my way through them at the moment, and I adore them. I just absolutely love them. So yeah, I'm a huge Diana Wynne Jones convert.
Yeah, she is absolutely brilliant. And she manages to write about some really nasty stuff in a way that's really quite accessible to sort of a mid-grade audience without dumbing it down as well, which is quite something.
Absolutely. I mean, the very first book, just the first couple of pages, when the boat that the children are on capsizes, it's so kind of frothy and light, but at the same time, it's just this horrible kind of, you know, dispatching of the parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Oh,
wonderful
God.
Writer.
Sorry. I'm in, again, that unfortunate position where I have not read half of the books that either of you have. In my defense, I'm dyslexic and struggled to read for a very long time, so I've only just gotten around to it recently. But I've never heard those two things put in a sentence before. Frothy and light and the dispatching of parents. These are not things I would normally associate with each other.
I mean, it goes on, it gets much, much worse, because it's not the lives of Christopher Chant, it's Charmed Life, isn't it?
Yes, that's the one.
And it's his sister Gwendolyn is a witch and quite talented, but Cat, she calls him Cat because apparently he has 9 lives, isn't actually all that good at magic. And it turns out later that she's basically taken all his extra lives and stuck them in a matchbook, and she's been using his lives to power her own magic and basically trying to murder her own brother. But this is a mid-grade children's book, and when you think about it, it's really horrible.
This sounds like the perfect thing for me to have read when I was young. Okay, this is something interesting. What is it about witches and giving them Welsh names? and this is more than, you know, you just mentioned that one, but it's a thing, isn't it? For some reason, we associate the Welsh with witches.
In my defence, I mean, my main character is called Ariane Wyngribble, but my grandfather on my father's side was Welsh, and so that was kind of why that name came about. I mean, I'd heard it at some point years ago, and I thought, what a beautiful name. And yeah, that's I stole it from my Welsh heritage. But I by no means think that all Welsh people are kind of witches, and certainly if they were, it wouldn't be a bad thing, because all the witches in my book tend to be very nice.
Well, I wonder whether it isn't also the association, you know, with the kind of that Celtic aspect, and you know, the Welsh have got a very rich folklore history, but also an association with niceness. We don't think of Welsh people and think, oh, they're horrible. There's a kind of there's a nice sort of idea about the Welsh, isn't there? It almost makes sense. If you're going to have a witch character and you want to define them as good, you give them a also, because Welsh spelling looks a little bit unusual English readers. So they look at the Welsh spelling, it looks a little bit different, it sounds very pleasant, quite rounded, it's got a nice, you know, a nice vowel, and there's immediately a kind of a nice association because, I guess, of the stereotype we give the Welsh. And also because of that history, that strong folklore history.
Think you're probably right. I think it's that the association of those, you know, the like you said, the words that look so different that makes them feel exotic and magical and kind of ancient at the same time. So I think that's definitely part of that might well be part of the appeal of naming her Ariamwyn. I think she's the only Welsh name that features in the book, though.
It is interesting, however, that you have drawn clearly from your own sort of environmental upbringing. I say environmental, you know what I mean. You know, you've drawn from within yourself for these characters. Has that happened in any other way at all?
Quite a few ways, and I didn't realize that it had until I was asked to go and talk to a friends group that supports one of the libraries that I work with, and it was only when I was preparing that I kind of thought, oh my goodness, I've stolen so many bits and pieces from you know, family and friends and things. So it's quite not in a kind of, you know, not in a massive way, but one of the things the at the start of the book, Ariamwyn is at her witch's evaluation ceremony. So this is the point where they're tested and they either become a fully fledged witch or, you know, they don't. And if they pass, they're given a silver star to wear, which marks them as a fully fledged witch. And I really think this has got something to do with the fact that my dad used to make me watch lots of westerns. And obviously it's the sheriff's badge, and I never twigged. I really like stars as kind of a symbol, and I just thought that was kind of, you know, one of these things that was kind of, oh well, I'll give her a you know, stars are associated with witches as well. But it was only later on when somebody said, have you know, what from your family and friends have you kind of brought into the story? And I was kind of thinking, I don't think I have really. And then suddenly I remembered all these blasted westerns I used to watch on rainy Sunday afternoons. Yeah, so that's definitely, there's definitely something of the sheriff about the witches in my book. And also the whole kind of point of her failing, that was very much a personal thing for me, because way, way back in the day, I was told by a teacher, no less, that I could try and do something, but basically I wouldn't succeed and I'd fail before I'd even started. And I just thought, well, just, you know, thanks a lot. And that's more or less what happens to Ariane when she's told she's kind of failed before she's even tried. And it's partly about proving to herself more than to anybody else that she can become a proper witch. So that was the kind of the essence of the beginning of the story as well. But that was a very personal bit. But yeah, it's not, I wouldn't say it's kind of like it's full of kind of therapeutic releasings of my soul.
But I do wonder, this has given me a thought, and I wonder whether actually another reason we now write about children as witches is a power thing, is that we're suddenly giving children the power to be magical, to literally shape their own destiny, to shape their own world. And I can understand why that's attractive, when especially you consider that, you know, children don't have much power. They're dictated in school, they're dictated at home, they don't have a lot of freedom, and they don't get that freedom until they're much older and they can start being more independent. And you know, obviously that's for safety and for a number of reasons. But regardless, they don't there. So it makes sense that, I mean, you know, you think about Harry Potter, these where is the supervision these kids are meant to be under? But they're not. And I do wonder whether the reason witches are so attractive is that they are not, I'm not trying to find the word, it's not accessible, that they have limitless sort of opportunity to be able to be something more than what they are, and the control is entirely with them.
I
Do you
think
know what I mean?
it's a way of giving children power, isn't it? Without making them adults before their time.
Exactly. So they can still have that wonderment, they can still have that innocence and sense of, you know, very black and white sense of right and wrong, which is kind of associated with children. And at the same time, they don't have to be adults. They can still be themselves. So I wonder whether that's why witches are so popular. Going back to sort of environments and sort of being influenced by your life and the stuff around you, I'm just going to very briefly, I know Jules, yours doesn't include witches, but it does include kind of modern witches in that sense.
Well, yeah, I suppose so.
And I wouldn't say yours is for children. It's YA, isn't it? It's young adult.
Yeah, it's young adult.
So, but you set it on the moors.
Yeah.
very monosyllabic response.
Yes, I set it on the moors.
yes, I did. What are you accusing me of? You set it on the moors, and you actually, you have history there, don't you? On the moors, where you yes, toil and...
For many years I lived alone, a life of contemplation.
Myself and the beast of Yorkshire. You know what I mean, you've got a family history in Yorkshire, don't you?
Actually, I don't, in Yorkshire, I do have some family that lives up there, but I don't know them terribly well, but the sort of sense of feeling of being connected to the land and to various places like that, particularly in Ireland, for example, that's definitely a factor. So I think perhaps I was drawing on that.
And yet you chose Yorkshire.
It was,
I guess, for other reasons. Yeah, well,
fitted with other factors in the book, but
there are, but again, there is still a connection there.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
And it's interesting how even in modern sort of fiction, the way that we're writing now, we're still very much drawn by the folklore of where we're from. You know, for instance, James, you're talking about the heart in your area, and Jules, you've got the moors and the connection with the land. And even with modern sort of stories, we're still, modern witch stories, we're still really pulled back to, you know, where we're from. And this connection with folklore, and that's the same with the Welsh names and whatnot. Am I talking rubbish?
No, I was just thinking, when I was kind of, you know, as when you start to write and you kind of imagine, because the book, The Apprentice, which isn't set in our world, it's set in a kind of English-like kind of place. The kind of, it's called the Four Kingdoms, and Highland, which is where Ariamwyn lives, is one of the Four Kingdoms, basically. It's an island. But I did think, and in very early drafts, it was set very near to the coast. And obviously, growing up in Norfolk, I was very close to the sea, and there was that kind of elemental kind of aspect to the book was probably, well, it's not less than it was then, but it was very much, I kind of imagined almost, you know, my kind of place was a bit like Norfolk, but now it's all set near a massive giant forest called the Great Wood, which again, lots of woods and things, you know, near to where I live. I like walking in woods, so it's all draws back. And again, there's something very magical about woods. There's something kind of I think, you know, as when I grew up, we had a small, tiny, tiny little wood at the bottom of the garden. And we used to all play in there. And, you know, it was the theatre of childhood, really, because, you know, a tree can be a tree. It can be a tower. It can be a fort. It can be anything you want it to be. And I think that's the wonderful thing about woods and landscape as well, is that as children, I did anyway, you kind of imagine it and adapt it to whatever kind of make believe you're part of at that time. So
that's a beautiful description.
Yeah,
theatre. That's wonderful and exactly right. I think you've really hit something there.
The bit you said about woods just reminded me of something that Richard Adams said in Watership Down, where you can be in the smallest copse of trees at a certain hour and get yourself turned around, because every small grouping of trees is still imagining that it's part of the great forest that once covered all of Britain.
Oh, wonderful.
And it's that sort of feeling. And yeah, I think that's so deeply ingrained in our psyche, which shows in our oral tales and our fairy tales and things.
Just reminded me about why I didn't read Watership Down. It's terrifying. But yes, you're right. And there is something magical. We do have associations, don't we? We have associations with woods and the land and things like that. And then I guess with the stereotypical aspects of witches and magic, which is, you know, broomsticks and wands and black cats and whatnot. Now, I feel like it's time to talk about some of the books that I certainly had growing up. And, you know, I remember my first real witch book with a witch in a positive light was The Worst Witch.
Yay!
Anyone else read The Worst Witch? Yay! And oddly enough, The Worst Witch, which actually, James, your book, when if we go onto the Chicken House website, it recommends The Worst Witch if we're... It recommends if you like The Worst Witch to check out your book. So I think that it's almost not in a similar strand, because I think yours is a little bit more gritty from what I've seen. The Worst Witch tended to be quite light and fluffy. But The Worst Witch was interesting because it kind of had a lot of formulas that you then sort of saw in later books like Harry Potter. So you had the strict teacher who was kind of severe and had the slicked back hair and whatnot, but then she wasn't actually as severe as people thought, and there was the enemy, the nemesis, the student nemesis. And oddly enough, these were all sort of characteristics that could have occurred in any other kind of just a school setting. It was really nothing to do with witches, but then they were witches. She had a tabby instead of a black cat and was literally the worst witch.
I read them as a child, and I have not read them for years and years and years. I mean, I think I was conscious that as soon as I started to write this book and I knew it was about witches, I didn't want to read a lot of witchy books because I didn't want to be overly influenced by other stories, because, you know, that would, well, it would be plagiarism, wouldn't it, basically? And we don't want that.
No.
So I've only just recently kind of gone back and looked at some of these kind of, you know, stories that I read as a child that had witches in it, and I haven't got back to the Worst Witch yet. But certainly, you know, those themes about this sort of authoritative grown up, the kind of the baddie who's kind of on your level, there are all sorts of things that we kind of see in lots of ways and lots of stories, whether it's about witches or not. They're kind of familiar things because they're things that we're experiencing as children as well, aren't they? So again, we make that connection through the story to the main characters and to the other characters that are around. So, but I think, I mean, those books have just endured so well. And you know, children still absolutely love them, don't they? Because they are just, like you say, that they just turned that idea of the witch completely on its head, really, in a way that perhaps children hadn't experienced up to that point. You know, you're still kind of in the fairy tale, you know, witches are bad. And then all of a sudden, here's a witch and she's actually not bad. And I think that was, but I think it's still kind of rare, isn't it? Because I was thinking, I made a little list of of my favourite witches, and there's not many of them that come off terribly well.
No, this is true. It's still quite rare to see it in children. I mean, the reason we don't think of it as rare is because obviously you do have things like Harry Potter, which have been highly successful worldwide. But as a collective, the genre is still quite small.
I think the only real change in that, I would say, is where the witches are in books for adults, and they tend to be nicer, or at least not neither one way or the other. Because I was thinking, you've got things like Practical Magic, where the sisters in that are witches, they're very lovely and kind of nice, but they're ordinary people. And then like The Witches of Eastwick, well, that's kind of, you know, that's neither one way or the other, is it? But certainly for children's books, I mean, I was thinking, you've got people like the Grand High Witch from The Witches by Roald Dahl. I mean, completely pure utter evil. I mean, she's just the best, isn't she, really? Like ripping your face off to scare a bunch of kids. And the White Witch from Narnia, you know, Chronicles of Narnia, all just really not very pleasant people at all. So I kind of feel like I'm trying to do my thing for witches' rights here, to make them nice again. Carry on the work that was started by Jill Murphy and The Worst Witch. But even, you know, even something like the Spooks Apprentice series, I don't know if either of you have read any of those. I've not read them all. I'm probably about three or four into that series. There's quite a lot of them. But there's the witches, the overall witches in those books tend to be very bad, but there are a couple, without trying to spoil it too much. One of the main characters is a girl called Alice Dean, and she is kind of a young witch. She was raised by witches, but she's taken in by the spook and the spook's apprentice, and they try to kind of suppress her her magical ability because they worry that it's going to make her evil. And I think that's really interesting that they can use magic as men and not be bad. But as soon as a woman uses some magic, oh, we need to stick her in a pit in the back garden and, you know, leave her there for 1,000 years. So I think, yeah, it's interesting that it's still fairly bad news if you're a witch in children's book, unless you happen to be at Hogwarts, being terribly unsupervised by all of the adults. I mean, that place would have been shut down by Ofsted in a heartbeat, wouldn't it?
It's my favourite moment of the first movie where Dumbledore's just there like, no one is allowed on that corridor unless you want to suffer a very terrible death. And you look at, you see a shot of the students and all of the other students kind of look down like, oh yes, we understand. And Harry looks up and narrows his eyes like, what? What kind of school is this?
I think we may have had like an electricity cupboard or something at my high school that was a bit like that. Don't go near the electricity cupboard or you'll die.
Yeah, except... this is no electricity cupboard. It's a three-headed dog guarding a philosopher's stone. Personally, I feel they could have probably hid it somewhere a little less obvious. Oh, and the other one was that no one is allowed into the forbidden forest. Absolutely not at all. Except on detention, where you'll go on your own with a giant who likes monsters and is kind of cowardly dog. That works. So Hogwarts as a school was wanting, which is why I think actually... everyone really loved it, because even the boring classes they talked about were not really boring, except for Professor Binns's history of magic. But
it was taught by someone who was dead.
Yeah, and hadn't realised he was dead. It was the fact that the school was so unsupervised, which probably made people really excited, because they thought these kids can really have their own adventure. And yeah, there was an element of danger, because there was a little bit of supervision. McGonagall would occasionally be around and Snape would sort of swoop in whenever he wanted. And you swoop in a very, very apt manner there. But for the most part, they were just doing kind of what they wanted. And they got up to all sorts of stuff. And I think that, and they got up to all sorts of stuff and then were rewarded for it. That was the thing.
Yeah.
Is that they broke a lot of rules. And sometimes they got punished. But for the most part, because what they were doing was technically, you know, good, even though it was against the law sometimes and against the rules, they did get rewarded for it. And I think as children that is attracted to us, because that's kind of the lives that we want to lead.
I mean, partly also it was tackling the how do you get parents out of the way in a children's book scenario.
Yeah, boarding schools is great. I think there's a reason why, you know, when you have stories like this, stories of wonder and stuff like that, they are normally set in some academy or boarding school where there are teachers, but the parents aren't there.
Yes, I think trying to get rid of parents.
Unless you're Diana Wynne Jones.
Five top
just
tips.
Pop them on a boat.
Yeah, I mean, that's always... you want your main character to be somebody that the children can relate to and look up to a little bit. But you need those parents to be out of the way. So whether that's, you know, like Narnia, where they go into a step through the wardrobe into a completely different place where, you know, their parents aren't going to be. And of course, before that, they'd already been removed because they were away because of being evacuees during the war.
So they got double removed from their
they
parents.
They got double removed, absolutely. But it is, you do kind of need that, you know, freedom from the grown-ups in the book to a certain extent for all of that wonderful stuff to happen. Because I think, you know, it's just, you know, you've got your parents kicking around after you, it's never going to be quite as much fun, is it, unfortunately? But yes, yeah, so I mean, I encountered that as well, how to dispatch some parents. So yes, one of them went away to be a soldier and the other one died. But even so, Ariane Wynne is mostly raised by her grandmother, actually. And then she's sent away as when she doesn't necessarily pass her test, but she's still given a job as a witch. And that's when she then gets sent away elsewhere to do it. So it was that kind of posting as her first job as a witch, which removes her from her kind of family connections and the familiar world that she knows.
Yeah, but
it's always I know, you know, I've spoken to other writers and it's kind of like, well, you know, do we have to get rid of the parents really? And it's kind of like, well, you don't have to, but it just, it gives you a bit of freedom as a writer and just makes it more fun, I think, for the reader as well, because you don't want parents constantly
it's
dinner time now. Stop dealing with that magical problem and come and eat your potatoes.
Yeah, well, and it makes it more fun for the character as well. And it also, it does a nice thing where kids feel that they're constantly being dictated by their parents. And then they read these characters who don't have their parents around. And at some point, all of these characters go, God, I wish my mum was here. And it kind of adds this new sort of, it's a cheeky way for writers to remind kids that their parents are not, are doing it normally to protect them. And so in the removal of the parents, not only do you give the child more freedom and liberty, but you also reinforce what the role of the parent actually is, and how, yeah, in some way, to begin with, it's fun that the parents aren't around, and then quickly everything dissolves into tears, and people kind of want their mum and dad back quite quickly.
I think, especially, in today's world where children, I grew up in the sort of 80s and early 90s, most of the 90s, I hope I'm still growing up, but as a sort of a young child, and we had a lot more freedom than children have now. We were allowed to go out on our bicycles, and as long as you were home before it got dark, which in the summer kind of gave you quite a big portion of the day. But children really don't have that now, for good reason, in lots of cases. But I think it's still nice for them to be able to experience it through reading, and to kind of see that, because I think in doing that, in having that actual physical freedom from your parents, that's where you start to kind of become, that's where you develop as a person, and also you start to become braver as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I was completely terrified of most things as a small child, and I think reading about brave children in books and brave deeds made me think, well, if they can do it, I can do it as well. And I think that's a really important aspect of books, and not just books that are about issues, but books that are full of fantasy and just, good old adventure books, because not every child that might be dealing with issues wants to read a book that's about the issue that they're dealing with. They might want to be completely removed from it and escape into some fantasy, which I completely, think is often not appreciated. So I think that's a really important thing as well. I mean, I certainly thought, like, the children in the Chronicles of Narnia, they were heroes, weren't they? They were complete heroes. I mean, at the end of the book, they're given the crown. And like, who wouldn't think that's quite a cool thing to do? But gosh, it was quite scary for them,
they were heroes. But then at the same time, I do wonder of the politics of Narnia, that their decision so that, they're crowned, and then Mr. Thomas comes by and goes, so what do you guys know about tax?
Yeah.
Capital punishment? What's your go on that?
It is a bit sort of, we must have someone who is not a native species to this world to rule it.
Yeah.
But then maybe that's where we're all going.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. We should like, I don't know.
Maybe if children were the rulers of our countries, we'd actually have less problems. Maybe Narnia was onto something. What?
I think you're right. Let's give it a try.
Let's
our own country and crown some children.
Hang on, historically, we have actually done that in the past, haven't we? It didn't turn out so well.
No.
Thorn helping them. That's what the problem was.
Oh, yeah, okay. So if they had...
Thorn, a couple of beavers.
Wait, was he a fawn? Was he a satyr?
No, he was a fawn.
He was a fawn. Stire. Stire. You know what? I can't speak today, so... He was a fawn, and they had some beavers, and they had a magical lion helping around,
he disappears quite a lot. He's not terribly helpful.
He's pretty, unhelpful, isn't he? He's meant to be a metaphor for God, though, wasn't he? So
yeah.
I guess you couldn't just have him around. But that would kind of be, he's the king. He should probably do something. Aslan just takes a lot of vacation time, arrives in the last minute to be killed. Revived and then goes back on vacation. To be honest, though, if I had been murdered horrifically, I too would want some vacation time.
Going back to James's point, I'm actually looking around to check he can't see my notes because he pretty much just made a point
Oh.
I had written down perfectly.
There we go. We have the. Well, hang on. Did James touch you in any way?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, you don't know. Apparently, the ideas can be
projecting.
The ideas can be.
And that is, as you say, why fantasy is important for children. And it's the fact that fantasy obviously removes you from your own problems, but lets you look at them through a different lens. And you sort of empathise with the character, and therefore when the character struggles and suffers and then overcomes the problem, then it allows you to see your own problems in a different light, and you've pretty much covered that entirely.
If we both think that, it must be right. That's all I'm saying.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
We're onto something.
I want to talk about a different sort of approach to witches in literature for children. It's slightly older children, and it's Terry Pratchett's Tiffany Aching series. And obviously it gets a bit older as it goes along because Tiffany herself grows up. But it's very much a case of the magic is very secondary. It's more about a mindset of being able to look at people and really see them and really see people who need help. And it's summed up best by Tiffany's grandmother, who's dead at the beginning of the series, who says, "You clothe them as is naked, you feed them as is hungry, and you help those as needs it." It's very much the witch presented almost as sort of, well, if you like, our healthcare workers today, who basically don't get paid very much and don't have a really great job because there's an awful lot of cutting toenails for old men involved. But it's worthwhile, rewarding work, and somebody needs to do it, and every witch has her own holding, and it's looked at in that way. And I thought that was a really interesting way of approaching it. I mean, he's obviously used the magic side of it to draw people in and capture children's imaginations, but it definitely brings up the, are you looking at people and thinking whether they need help? Are you looking at them and thinking, oh, I don't like them very much because they're different, because they're a bit smelly, because they're old?
But it's not, the interesting thing is not actually a new idea.
No.
We can see, but you think about witches historically, and that's kind of what they were. They were the healing women, and that was not only was it a thankless job because they would then be ostracized, despite the fact that they were helping out, but they could also be burnt to death for their troubles.
They don't escape it in this series either. That's one of the things that Tiffany very much stands against, is the fact that there was an old woman who probably wasn't a witch, but because I think there was a time when the sheep were dying on the hills or something like that, this woman, unfortunately, being friendless and old and generally not liked, ended up dying because people formed a mob. And she decided then, at sort of about 8 years old, that she wanted to be a witch so that she could be sure that it wouldn't ever happen again. And it's that sort of mindset. So I suppose it's different from the finding out, having Hagrid turn up and say, "You're a wizard, Harry."
Yeah, but that isn't it. The conscious decision to become a witch, not to be chosen, but to have the power to do it yourself.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting idea.
It's similar to kind of Bedknobs and Broomsticks, isn't it, where she's desperate to become a trainee witch, and she's after her book to make that happen and things.
Yeah.
And I, you know, in a kind of similar way, I suppose, and again, the Pratchett ones aren't ones that I've read, so I can't comment too much. But I think, like you said, that idea that historically we know now that a lot of those poor people that were burnt as witches were actually just trying to help people. And I guess I took that on board a bit as I kind of set out with my story. And also this idea that, you know, that my witch was going to be a good witch. But I was conscious I didn't want to do a book where somebody turns up and says, "You have magical powers and we're now going to train you to use them." Because whilst I love those types of books, I think they're wonderful, I wanted to know what happened next. So what happened when that person had been trained? So I wanted to kind of go out and explore the world and see somebody working and being the witch. And again, the similarity with the Pratchett, the witches in my book are your kind of go-to person. If you've got a magical problem happening in your house, say for example you've got an infestation of a magical creature, you know, you might have some snotlings under the stairs, then you would get your local witch to come round and deal with it. And that's how the sort of premise of the witches in my book. Somebody described it as the worst witch meets call the midwife. Except they don't have bicycles. Nice. Some of them have bicycles, but yeah, so I kind of like the idea of not necessarily having to go through the, and now we're going to teach you how to cast a spell, and we're going to teach you how to ride around on a broomstick, and it's all going to be a mystery to you. I wanted it to be that this person is a witch, you know, they were kind of born a witch, and this is all they've ever wanted to do, was to help people. A bit like you said with Tiffany. So yeah, I think there's kind of that's appealing, isn't it? In a way, I think the fact that we're not necessarily just discovering somebody at the beginning of their story, that we're almost coming in partway through, in a way. I quite like that.
I agree with you. I'm actually working on a series at the moment. It's YA. And it's a series called the Kestrel Saga. And Kestrel isn't a witch, she's actually a wizard. Now there's a difference in my world to witches and wizards. Witches are people who can call upon external power, so they can make contract with demons and fairies and stuff like that and nature. Wizards have their own power inside of them, so anyone can be a witch if they want to. Some people are more apt at it than others, but anyone can be a witch. And wizards can do the same thing as witches, but they also have a little bit of power inside of them, which is their own. And she kind of works within the community. It's a sort of an underground magical community that operates just living alongside regular people in sort of urban London. And yeah, she's basically glorified pest control. so she sort of gets called in to sort of deal with pixies and stuff like that have infested magical homes or hauntings and things like that. And it's a similar idea that witches are either sort of witches now, how we write them now, is they deal with magical problems, like you, your character. She goes out and she's dealing with these disturbances in people's homes, and that's why she gets her posting. And obviously, I don't want to give too much away. I've had a look at a little bit about your book, and she notices something is actually very wrong in the area that she's in, that there's something much bigger going on. But yeah, and I agree. Initially, in my first draft of the Kestrel Saga, Kestrel wasn't going to realise she was a wizard, and she was going to have to go through the whole motions of it, whereas now, in mine, it's that she knows she's a wizard, and she actually quit from the whole thing, and sort of said, nope, not going to do it anymore, I've been in enough danger, I'm just going to live a normal life, and then something happens which kind of forces her to sort of get back into it. And I found that the approach was much nicer, because like you, I didn't want to have to go through the whole motions of her learning how to do it. I just wanted her to get on with the story to see what would happen after she knew how to do it. And I think in some ways Harry Potter worked, because we were meant to be going through the whole journey with him. It was for children 11 years old who were meant to be going to Hogwarts with him, so they were learning to ride broomsticks with him, they were learning to do all that stuff. But in the context of The Apprentice Witch, that's not set in this world. It's set in a new world, and you kind of just want to grab people and pull them on an adventure, don't you?
Yeah, and also the magic is not a secret. It's part of the world. So everybody witnesses magic, you know, kind of on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not something that's kind of happens behind closed doors. It's very out there and obvious. Somebody did ask me recently and said, so are there wizards in your book then as well? And I said, no, there's only witches. And so there are no boys then. And I was like, the boys can be witches if they want to be. We don't meet any boy witches in the Apprentice Witch, but in my head there's nothing to stop a boy from, you know, being a witch if he's been born and he has that ability. But I'm not calling them wizards, they're just boy witches.
Do you have any bad witches at all in your book?
Well, I think
without giving anything away.
Yeah. I mean, there is I mean, if you have a look on the Chicken House website, it kind of gives you an indication of where things are going. So Ariane Wynne's kind of school bully type character, who's called Gemma Alverstone. She's kind of a slightly upper class kind of goody two shoes. And she's picked on Ariane Wynne for years. And when Ariane Wynne goes off to her posting to Lull, which is the little town where she goes to work, she thinks, because it's, you know, it's kind of the back of beyond, they're literally, you know, miles and miles away from anywhere. And she thinks, well, she never expects to see Gemma again. And then it turns out that Gemma is actually the favourite niece of the mayor of Lull, who is not Ariane Wynne's biggest fan in any case. And then Gemma comes for a holiday, and it all goes badly wrong from there on out, really, because it just makes life worse for Ariane Wynne, because she's there, but also Gemma causes some trouble of her own as well. So yeah, so there are bad witches, but it's like anybody. I mean, you could have I was going to say an evil electrician there.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, just because they've come around to fix your electrics, it doesn't mean they're necessarily a very nice person. I'm going to get into trouble with electricians now, aren't I? But yeah, so there's Gemma is our main bad witch in The Apprentice Witch. But on the whole, they're nice, good people. And it's not the magic that makes Gemma a bad person. It's Gemma that makes Gemma a bad person.
Yeah.
She does it all on her own.
Yes.
Right, well, we're probably heading up to time, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because I could talk for about another hour, because it's really interesting.
So, well, let's have a quick look at what we've covered. We've looked at the influence of folklore and environment, which in children's books and witch books. We've looked at why we've made children into witches in these books, and the sort of the power that gives. What are the books we've looked at?
Well, Diana Wynne Jones, Tiffany A. King, The Worst Witch.
Harry Potter,
of course. And we've also looked at why fantasy is important in general, particularly for children.
And also a little bit about the history of witches themselves and the turnover that's happened. Yeah, I think we've covered quite a lot.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure having you with us.
So. Oh, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
And yeah, everybody, don't forget to go and check out The Apprentice Witch. It's coming out on the 2nd of July, and it's being published by The Chicken House, so go and pre-order today.
I really want to read it.
So do I.
It's right up my street, that.
Thanks.
I want to take it and go back in time and give it to younger me as well, because I think older me is going to enjoy it, but younger me would also have very much enjoyed
it. Absolutely.
That's lovely.
So thank you very much. Yeah, tune in next week for our next episode. Yeah, hopefully it'd be nice to have you on the show again sometime, James.
I'd be delighted to come back. It's been really good fun.
If you are enjoying our podcast, remember you can subscribe and get the podcast delivered straight to your listening device of choice, either through Podbean or through iTunes.
Thank you and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.